Good afternoon, Mr. Hirsch.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May I proceed?
Yes.
May it please the court, this is an appeal on two pure questions of law. The first question is purely one of bankruptcy court jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1334B, and in its simplest form, it posits the following question. On the date of the removal of Capitol Hill Group's Superior Court case filed on September 7, 2007, was there arising in jurisdiction so as to justify Judge Lamberth's refusal to remand for lack of jurisdiction? The second question is equally a pure question of law, and that is, under the federal res judicata law principles applicable, could Judge Lamberth have granted, and properly so, was he misconstruing the applicable law of res judicata in granting summary judgment on the defense of res judicata? Now, going to the first question, a lot has been written about arising in, especially in these briefs, and I'd like to cut to the core of my argument. There are two reasons why there was no arising in jurisdiction on September 7, 2007. The second reason actually is the more compelling one, because it's based on the statute, and that is that after the bankruptcy case was generally closed on January 21, 2004, because of the final decree had been entered by bankruptcy Judge Teel, and most certainly after June 20, 2007, when it was totally administratively closed by Judge Teel, so there was no even vestigial residue of the bankruptcy case left, after those two dates, Your Honors, there can be no arising in jurisdiction. Arising in jurisdiction differs from arising under jurisdiction because arising under jurisdiction is unlimited under the bankruptcy code. It's a full broad grant. As long as the cause of action arises under a specific section of the code, you don't have to have an extant underlying subsisting bankruptcy case. Not so with related to jurisdiction and with arising in jurisdiction. Both forms of the latter, there has to be a subsisting underlying extant bankruptcy case. It is as simple as that. It's not because I say so. It's not because some legal commentator says so. It's because Congress says so in 1334B. And it is a clear, unambiguous provision, about as clear and unambiguous as statutory jurisdictional language is. We don't have to get into the legislative history. The Ron Peer case, seminal Supreme Court case, Judge Scalia instructs that nowhere is the resort to legislative history as unnecessary and totally improper, actually, as in a situation where the statutory language is clear and unambiguous. I submit that it is, and for that reason, there could be no longer any arising in jurisdiction. Now, if I may jump back to my first argument, there was no arising in jurisdiction ever over the dispute that brings us here today. At best, prior to January 21, 2004, because of a tenuous link between the zoning problem with the D.C. authorities and the prior Chapter 11 case, there could have been, there possibly was related to jurisdiction, but never arising in jurisdiction, because the subject matter, the stuff that they were litigating with the D.C. government, whether in bankruptcy court or before the ZA or the BZA, is purely local law stuff with no underbrush whatsoever of bankruptcy law. So it is as simple as that. For that reason, there would have been a related to jurisdiction, but Your Honor, that jurisdiction also ceases as of January 21, 2004.
Go ahead.
Yes, Your
Honor. Wasn't the claim here based on representation during the bankruptcy proceeding?
But Your Honor, that is purely fortuitous. Purely, this dispute, if Congress had never in its wisdom passed a bankruptcy law, or if Capitol Hill Group had never heard of it, or never availed of it, it would have been in the same place. This is a classical freestanding dispute that Judge Brown would have had a practical existence outside of the bankruptcy court. They would have gotten into the same difficulty with the zoning authority. And in this case, the impetus for that litigation was the Stanton Hills Civic Association. It's the citizens group that took the initiative. They would have gotten into that bankruptcy or no bankruptcy.
I understand that this could have been a freestanding dispute, but under these particular facts, it wasn't Pittman the representing the Capitol Hill group in bankruptcy when they were dealing with...
Yes, Your Honor, but that is fortuitous. And to avoid the problem of over-including within the sweep of arising in jurisdiction things that should not be within that, I submit that of all the tests, all the circuit courts that have ever had to confront the scope of arising in this court, from my research, has never had to confront that. Only the lower courts here have downstairs, is the Torkelson test. Torkelson is the only properly decided arising in case that deals with misfeasance by an estate or by an estate representative. And why? It's the only test that pays heed to the legislative language, that takes into account all of the limitations that Congress wrote into 1334B for arising in and related to jurisdiction. Why? It asks three questions. Does it arise under state law? Well, clearly, our dispute is under local zoning law. Does it have practical existence outside of the bankruptcy code? And just as I've explained to our Honor Judge Brown a minute ago, this dispute would surely have existed as a practical matter in or outside of bankruptcy code. It doesn't matter. Three, does it have an impact on the estate? And this is where our case flunks the arising in test, if you will. Why? Because after the closure of the case on January 21 through the final decree, which is a general closure of the case, there is no longer a mandate. Congress said that the federal courts have a mandate for arising in and related to only if there is a case in Title 11. When that case is gone, there is no mandate. And the Fifth Circuit, In re Craig Stores, Your Honors, is a case that Mr. McKay likes to cite. But in the second sentence of that case, the court says exactly what I'm saying. The Fifth says bankruptcy jurisdiction, certain types of bankruptcy jurisdiction, cease upon estate termination. It's only arising under jurisdiction that doesn't. This is not a case of arising under jurisdiction. Nobody ever said that.
Can I ask you two questions first?
Yes, Your Honor.
If this were a case about legal malpractice in the bankruptcy proceedings themselves, would your position be the same?
Your Honor, if the case did not arise under, if it was a malpractice case involving bankruptcy law, and if it arose after the closure of the case, in other words, if the suit were filed after the closure of the case, because if that case does not arise under federal bankruptcy, if it arises under state or local law, the position would be the same. And it's not because I say so. It's because the way the statute is written.
Can I ask you one other question, which is, didn't your client obtain approval of the bankruptcy court for the representation by Shaw Pittman in these other legal matters?
Your Honor, that is not exactly correct. And I'd like to walk the court basically through the genesis. And this is based on the complaint. The complaint that I filed in Superior Court on September 7th, I believe in paragraph I, recites very specifically, Judge Kavanaugh, that the genesis of the dispute was an engagement in March of 1999, almost 3 years prior to the filing of the
bankruptcy. I'm aware of that, but isn't it also the case that in the application of the debtor to employ Shaw Pittman, that it said the professional services Shaw Pittman will render includes representation with respect to lawsuits to which the debtor is or may be a party, and that was the basis for the approval by Judge Teal, I believe, of the representation. And what are we to make of that?
Your Honor, that is... Obviously, that's the way it happens in real life. When a law firm that provides a general service as general counsel, if you will, to the debtor or possession, always frame their applications that they brought us. I've done it many times before Judge Teal, probably too numerous to recount, and it's always done that way. However, that employment in and of itself does not convert this into permanent bankruptcy jurisdiction. You can't permanently tether the fact that there was that employment, even if it said zoning disputes, even if it said representation, Judge Kavanaugh, before the BZA, because Congress doesn't give the court, the federal courts writ large on bankruptcy jurisdiction except for arising under. Arising under is permanently tethered to the bankruptcy case. So you don't have to have an existing bankruptcy case. You can have arising under bankruptcy jurisdiction in perpetuity. But that's not so. With a related to by the terms of the statute, 1334 ceases, arising in ceases for the same reason. And Judge Kavanaugh, I have made, I think, on this record, a very important, you could call it a concession or you could call it an admission. The fact that there was a nexus between the loose nexus between the reorganization or the so-called ability to reorganize and the zoning dispute, ab initio, while the estate was open, possibly gave rise to related to jurisdiction.
Well, that's not much of a concession, right? Because that means it would go back to D.C. court, right? D.C. Superior Court.
But Your Honor, but my point is that I didn't write the statute. Your Honor's didn't write. Congress wrote the statute, said that for related to and for arising in, the jurisdiction stops. And at the latest, as of January 21, 2004, it stopped. And at every vestige of the case, administrative, jurisdictional, is wiped off the books as of the date of the closure of the case on June 20th, 2004. Now, Your Honors, I haven't said anything yet about res judicata, but I have one organizing theme about res judicata that I'd like to tell you. Mr. McKay raises a very good point in all of his briefs. He said, well, how can you get around six courts of appeals that say that it's res judicata? There's one fundamental distinction between this case and the six courts of appeals. And it comes down to one word. And I'm not being cute, and I'm not oversimplifying, disgorgement. Why is there res judicata in Southmark? Why is there res judicata in Interlogic Trace? Why does the First Circuit in Iannocchino says that there is res judicata, and also in the Fourth Circuit when it says we have to hold Mr. Grouse's feet to the fire? Because the danger, the policy evil that they're trying to deal with is the fact that someone like CHG, while the case is open, while the creditors are not satisfied with 100 or paid 100 cents a dollar plus interest, will take a favorable verdict for legal malpractice, file a motion for reconsideration, and that's exactly the way the First Circuit puts it in Iannocchino, and they can undo the fee award. Here you can't undo anything because you've paid the creditors 100 cents on the dollar. The case is closed. It's closed jurisdictionally. It's closed administratively. It's closed every which way, Your Honors. And disgorgement is one of those remedies that is not there for the benefit of non-estate parties, like the reorganized debtor. The bankruptcy code and bankruptcy jurisdiction are not there to facilitate remedies for anyone except the estate. So there is no danger of disgorgement anymore, because disgorgement only exists to augment the estate, but there's nothing to augment when this is the most spectacular bankruptcy that I've seen in this district in a long time.
But doesn't one of the bases, it seems to me, for saying that res judicata should apply is whether or not the claim that you're trying to prosecute could actually have an impact on an order that's already been made by the bankruptcy court. And if you look at money as fungible, let's say, if you succeeded, wouldn't that have an effect?
No, Your Honor. It depends upon the nature of my theory. And this is an issue that the Andrews case, the Supreme Court of Alaska, addresses this very exact point that Your Honor, Judge Brown, are raising. If the only purpose of bringing and the remedy that one seeks in the subsequent professional liability case is to get a measure of damages up to the amount of the fees, then I would agree with you. But I am going to make a concession on this record because I think that it is consistent with case law and that you could say that what is unimpeachable, in other words, what cannot be undone, is Shaw Pittman's fees. We are not seeking disgorgement of the fees. We would have to prove that we have a measure of damages once we prove liability that is not based on restitution, that is completely tort-based, like consequential damages. And a close reading of the Andrews case in the Supreme Court of Alaska points this up, Your Honor. Same thing with the analysis of the Maryland Court of Appeals in the veterinary case, Roland v. Harrison. There is something that becomes sacrosanct as a result of the prior litigation. That is that you cannot seek disgorgement. You cannot seek remission of the fees. Can you prove some other measure of damages? That's precisely my point. In tort, you should be allowed to do that. If all we had was that, I wouldn't be here, Your Honor, because it would be over. But that's not the that is not the law. And the reason it's not the law, Your Honor, is in bankruptcy, it's even more apparent. The Second Circuit has a wonderful test. What I call in my reply brief the Second Circuit gloss. The Second Circuit, when it examines whether a prior fee order can be from bankruptcy court, can be res judicata upon a subsequent claim, in this claim a claim against an auctioneer, it, in addition to the restatement position, and that it asked, well, did it arise in a compulsory counterclaim environment? Then we go to the next step. If it didn't arise, as in this case, in a compulsory counterclaim, Second Circuit says, and this is the gloss that I think you should put on the on this nullification or substantial impairment theory, does the subsequent claim threaten to undo the plan of reorganization? Absolutely not. It is paid for. The creditors have been paid 100 cents on the dollar plus interest, which is most spectacular in the annals of Chapter 11. In practice, Your Honor, there is no danger of undoing it. It's beyond undoing. And that's my whole point about disgorgement. The danger that the six other sister circuits are always worried about is disgorgement. But here we're right. Beyond disgorgement.
You've gone way over your time. So finish your sentence, and that'll be it.
My point is, Your Honors, that for the same reason that there is no jurisdiction, because it is there's no extant bankruptcy case, that reason also spills over and flows over into the res judicata analysis, whether you want to apply the Second Circuit gloss or just the general restatement section 22.2b analysis. There can be no nullification, no substantial impairment, because all of that connotes disgorgement, and there's no jurisdiction to disgorge. We're past that. This is a unique case, but Your Honors, in all seriousness, the fact that there is no possibility of disgorgement is dispositive here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McKay.
May it please the court, Jack McKay on behalf of the appellees. Mr. Hirsch is, I think, swimming upstream and doing the best job he can on both points that he made to the court. The first is the issue of jurisdiction. This court, there's no reason for this court not to join the four of the circuit courts of appeals and the two district courts that have held that there is a rising in jurisdiction for precisely this kind of claim, where a Section 327 professional whose engagement was approved by the bankruptcy court, whose services were monitored by the bankruptcy court, whose fees were approved by the bankruptcy court, that when a malpractice claim is brought against that professional, that falls within the arising in jurisdiction. We've cited those cases there in our brief, and I won't repeat them all here. Mr. Hirsch's named several.
It's a little different, right? Because this case, the malpractice alleged, is not in the bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, Your Honor, it's not in the bankruptcy proceedings, since it's not somebody advising how to formulate a plan, for example. Right. But I think that's as many of the distinctions that the appellants have made, that's a distinction without a difference, because in this case, first of all, the litigation was in the bankruptcy court. Shaw Pittman filed on behalf of CHG a declaratory judgment action, an adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court. But, Your Honor, if you look at the cases that I cited a moment ago, a number of them involved non-bankruptcy, strict bankruptcy services. In the Iannucci case, the lawyer there advised to take a default on a state court action. In the Elia case, the lawyers had been involved in nine non-bankruptcy state and federal court actions, and there, it was their services there that was being evaluated. And in the Southmark case, it was an evaluation by an accountant of claims, non-bankruptcy claims against Drexel Burnham. So I don't think the fact that it's not, and Your Honor, you have to think about what you would result that would lead to. If somebody makes an error in drafting a plan, he's before the bankruptcy court for jurisdiction. If he goes out and litigates a matter that's in the disclosure plan, it's something that has to be dealt with. If you look in the appendix at 1147, this zoning litigation was specifically mentioned as something that had to be dealt with for a plan to be confirmed. Under 11 U.S.C. 1129, the company had to be in compliance with local law for the plan to be confirmed. So it becomes, in my view, sort of preposterous to say this is not a bankruptcy matter when it was essential to both the disclosure plan implementation and to having a plan approved at all, because you had to be in compliance with state law.
Once you're in bankruptcy and there's litigation that's separate from the bankruptcy, say a product liability action or contract dispute, do you always have to obtain approval from the bankruptcy court of the fees that will be expended for that separate action?
I suppose, Your Honor, you could strike a separate contract with the debtor, but I think that it all still have to, if you're going to be taking assets of the estate and working on behalf of the debtor, I think you're going to have approval.
The case that it's always, any legal malpractice case arising out of litigation with a company that's in bankruptcy will be before the bankruptcy court. That's, I think, the clear rule you're seeking, but I just want to be sure I understand everything.
I don't know that I have to go that far. I think that may be the logical outcome, but for this case, there is no doubt that these were, what Your Honor is hypothesizing might be a case where, for example, after the petition was filed, a breach of contract claim arose. I'm not sure that that would necessarily fall within the arising in jurisdiction. But here we have an issue that the court knew about, the bankruptcy court knew about. It was in the disclosure plan. The debtor said it had to be litigated. It was litigated. It was litigated before the bankruptcy court. And the bankruptcy court approved all those fees. I think the test should be and would be whether the bankruptcy court looked at the fees as they did here. And in this case, they found the services to have been rendered in a professional way, and he used the word professional on two other occasions, Judge Teel did in his findings. So there was an evaluation of the services. I think that brings it within arising in. I was surprised that Mr. Hirsch relied on 1334B, because actually I plan to argue from 1334B, which says that the district court or the the district court shall have original jurisdiction of all civil proceedings arising in cases under Title 11. Well, there's no doubt that this issue arose in a Chapter 11 case, because as we've just discussed, it was approved by the bankruptcy court. The engagement was sanctioned, and the fees were approved by the bankruptcy court, and it was services that were necessary. So I would think that 1334B argues just the contrary of what Mr. Hirsch does. With respect to the closed issue case, the closed case issue, there is not a single case of the ones that we've cited or anything that Mr. Hirsch has cited where the court went off and found that there was no arising in jurisdiction against a 327 professional because the case was closed at the time the claim was brought. And there's good reason for that. What that would lend is exactly what happened here, which is CHG was very coy, if not deceptive, in its answers to the bankruptcy court about whether it had claims when there was a hearing on whether the case should be closed or not. And Shaw Pittman asked that the case not be closed because it feared claims would be brought. The CHG got the case closed. They opposed opposed the case from remaining open and got the case closed, and then 3 months later they filed suit. So if you sanction the rule that Mr. Hirsch has, then there's this kind of games plan could always go on. You would simply sit on your hands, wait till the case was actually closed, then file suit and say, oh my gosh, I'm now in superior court because this case has been closed. There's no rhyme or reason for that. And in fact, in the cases that we've cited, an example of Seven Fields, the Third Circuit case, I think it's actually Gerstadt is the correct name. That case had been closed. It was reopened. In that case, and there's no, we've cited a whole lot of cases that say that the opening or closing of a case is purely administrative and not jurisdictional in any way. And one case that's not in our briefs but I invite the court's attention to is the Leach case, which is a bankruptcy case at 194 Bankruptcy Reporter 812, where the court said that opening and closing is not jurisdictional. In that case, simply because the court allowed an adversary proceeding to go forward, they said the case was necessarily reopened automatically. And I think that would be the situation here. I suppose that you could remand this case to the district court to remand it into the bankruptcy court to open it, but that seems to have no rhyme or reason to do that. This is a proceeding that arose in that case. That case may be technically closed, but that's only an administrative matter at this point. The effect on the estate. Mr. Hirsch said that there could be no effect on the estate because his estate was closed. If the rule that there could be no effect on the estate meant that there could never be jurisdiction, then you would have, in the cases that we cited, a number of cases that there could not be res judicata because there's not a plan in a number of these cases. Under a liquidation, under Chapter 7, there's no plan, so there's no plan that can be affected. And yet these cases, and we've cited those in our briefs, Iannoccia was a case where the debtor was in Chapter 7, res judicata, arising in jurisdiction was found, res judicata was found, despite the fact that they were in Chapter 7, where there was no plan, there could be no effect on any estate. On any bankruptcy reorganization plan. Let me talk for just a moment about Mr. Hirsch's point with regard to res judicata. Before I do that, I just want to say I thought the real issue that the court would face with res judicata was should they have known about the claims and should they have been able and been required to bring those claims in the various fee petitions. This case, is actually stronger for finding that the debtor here had the obligation to bring these claims because he made so many statements and so many admissions regarding his feelings about the representation. If your honors will look at page 968 of the appendix, Mr. Hartman, representing CHG, said that he had been looking at Shaw Pittman's practices since the fall of 2003, billing and other practices, he called it. At appendix 952 to 953, CHG talked about Shaw Pittman's breaches of fiduciary duty. At pages 955 and 957 of the appendix, they said that Shaw Pittman had violated various bar rules. They claimed that Shaw Pittman had committed malpractice in connection with a copyright issue involving Cassidy and Pinkard and a brochure that had been printed. And you'll find that at appendix 975 and appendix 1279. And they told the district court on the appeal of the first fee application that Shaw Pittman had breached numerous rules and breached its fiduciary duties to CHG. And that's at 313 BR 344, 349. And unlike none of the other cases where a duty to bring the claim was found, CHG actually engaged in discovery of Shaw Pittman with respect to its performance and its fees. There was 3 days of document review of every file and document in the case. There was a deposition of Mr. Potter, who was the lead attorney, and then he was examined again on the stand on more than one occasion. So you have more here with respect to the duty, in my view, the duty to bring a claim than you would find in any of the other cases. And the Iannoccia case is one where the person, even though they were pro se, they were found to be required to bring their claims at the time the fee petition was brought. The same is true of Grouse, where the court said that the facts there met the test that the debtor should have known the real likelihood of a malpractice claim at the date of the final fee order. They had alleged incompetence of the law firm, Lenos and Blocker. The firm had withdrawn, just as it had here, which showed a deterioration of the attorney-client relationship, and they were found to be on a duty to bring their claim. With respect to this issue of the effect on and disgorgement, I think, as Judge Brown said, again, it's a distinction without a difference. If Shaw Pittman gets to keep $1 million that it received at the time of the fee award, but loses $5 million in a malpractice claim, that's simply undermining and upsetting the fee award, and it nullifies it in effect. And it also, you're challenging the fee award because the bankruptcy judge, in a decision affirmed by the district judge, found Shaw Pittman's services to be professional. Obviously, the opposite conclusion will be reached if the if a malpractice claim went forward and went to judgment. But there's also, Your Honor, the fact that there is a direct effect even on the plan here, which Mr. Hirsch looks for. Under the plan, it's Section 5, and it's found at the Appendix 1181. No professional rendering services in the plan, no professional, is to be liable for formulating, implementing the plan or the disclosure statement. And, of course, Shaw Pittman did exactly that. At a minimum, it implemented the disclosure statement, which required litigation over the zoning issues. So you would have an effect, as the cases that we have cited show, about undermining the fee award, which meets the test that there must be some effect on a prior judgment under Restatement Judgment Section 22. But you also meet this new test, which Mr. Hirsch would put in, which he says comes from the Second Circuit, that there must be an effect on the plan, because here there would be an effect on the plan because of the specific provision that professionals were not to be liable. I've gone over my time. Those are my points with respect to both jurisdiction and res judicata, and I invite the court and ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you. Does Mr. Hirsch have any time? All right, take 1 minute, Mr. Hirsch.
There are three points that I'd like to make. There is a fundamental misconception throughout this case, and my apologies if I'm guilty of having contributed to it, that what would be the malpractice counterclaim or the liability litigation could have been brought before Judge Teel. Not so. After January 21st, 2004, there would have been no jurisdiction left, because that's the general closure of the case. Now, bankruptcy jurisdiction and counterclaims works very differently than things in the district court under 1331 jurisdiction. In 1331 jurisdiction matters, there is statutory supplemental jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1367. Not so with bankruptcy court. If claim wasn't compulsory, which it wasn't, because fee litigation doesn't have is not subject to compulsory counterclaims, and that's what Iannocchino says in the Fourth Circuit, it would have been a permissive counterclaim at best, even if we had known about it, which we didn't as of January 21. As a matter of fact, the delivery omission was 9 months later. So there was no knowledge whatsoever. And that is an incontestable fact. But even if we had known about it, there was no obligation to bring it in a court that had no jurisdiction over it, because the counterclaim, the permissive counterclaim, has to have an independent jurisdictional basis. The fee doesn't drag with it the malpractice. In 1367 does not exist in bankruptcy jurisdiction. In other words, the fact that that a compulsory counterclaim would lie and that you would know about it doesn't. Is a matter that is either the non-compulsory counterclaim has to have an independent jurisdictional basis, and because it doesn't pass muster as an independent jurisdictional footing after January 21st, because in bankruptcy jurisprudence there is no such thing as 1367 jurisdiction. This is a very complex.
Wasn't there a complaint brought by CHG in the bankruptcy court against the D.C. agency?
But, Your Honor, that complaint was brought before plan confirmation. There's no question that there was wide open jurisdiction. Judge Kavanaugh, what I'm saying,
you're saying after it's closed. Got
exactly.
It.
Exactly. The Got sea it. Change, January 21, puts this thing on a completely different footing. So we've all, unfortunately, everyone at these tables, all the spectators, and I apologize, for this, we've all fallen into this mind trap, and so did Judge Lambeth with all due respect, that we could have brought it. You can't bring something after January 21, 2004, over which the bankruptcy judge lacked fundamental subject matter jurisdiction.
Why wasn't the malpractice claim a compulsory claim?
Your Honor.
Was your hearing on the fee litigation, was that an adversary proceeding?
No, Your Honor, that's precisely the point. It's under, fee litigation is under the 9000 series of the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure, Judge Brown. The 9000 doesn't have a compulsory counterclaim provision in like 13A. And Iannocchino is actually the only properly decided on res judicata doctrinally, if you're going to be faithful and intellectually rigorous. It's the only properly decided case of all these six cases on res judicata. Why? Because There, the First Circuit was very, very intellectually honest, and he said, you know what? There is no compulsory counterclaim jurisdiction. So what is the basis for res judicata? Well, we have to go to the next level, 22 restatement second of judgments. Does it undercut? Yes, it undercuts, and there's a potential for nullification. Why? Because there's an open estate, and in an open estate situation where you haven't satisfied your creditors, you can seek disgorgement. Every dollar of disgorgement augments the estate and is one more dollar in the pockets of the unsecured creditors, but here you can't overpay them. Because in bank, when the estate is closed and you've paid 100 cents on the dollar plus interest, which is very rare in the annals of confirmed bankruptcy plans that actually that are feasible, then the next dollar that comes in doesn't belong to the creditors. That bonus or surplus reverts back to Dr. Shin and Capitol Hill Group. That's the way bankruptcy code works. In other words, if you've satisfied the creditors to the maximum hilt, then any additional dividend flows now back to the reorganized debtor. But bankruptcy is not concerned with the fortunes of the reorganized debtor. And that's precisely my point. There's no compulsory counterclaim environment. There's no undercutting here because there can't be disgorgement, whether you do it under 22 print B2, the way the Alaska Supreme Court did it with legal malpractice, Judge Brown, or the way the Maryland Court of Appeals did it with a veterinary malpractice, or whether you
do
it
this. We have your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.